This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. When District 71 State Representative Stan Lambert's office announced his retirement, who would have thought so many would announce their intentions to run for that office? After 9 years in office, the Abilene Republican said he's calling it quits. Since then, nearly a half dozen Republicans have announced they want to be on the ballot. Paul Fabrizio, a frequent contributor to the West Texas Dispatch and political science professor at McMurray University, joins us now. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, before we talk about potential successors, let's talk about Lambert for a moment. He angered Abbott and Paxton in 2023. He still won re-election last year, while a dozen other Republicans who opposed that voucher program, they crossed Abbott and they were ousted. It seems like maybe he is leaving on top.
Yeah, I think this is actually what he's thinking about. Is he survived this nasty re-election fight last year, and he's back in the good graces. I mean, he's been endorsed by President Trump, I believe, for re-election. So it's like, now's the time to go. So why not do it?
If you had to rate Stan Lambert's accomplishments over the 9 years, how did he do?
I'm not sure what kind of rating scale you want to
okay,
use. What I would argue is that Stan Lambert was a master at local politics. He understood local issues. He understood where people are locally, and he strove to represent them in a statewide forum. And he did this in a time when that was not necessarily the way the Republican Party was going. So the Republican Party, in essence, is becoming nationalized, where the issues that President Trump and the White House is what he's talking about are also the issues that local candidates are talking about. And Stan, I think, chose to represent the local people in local issues, focusing on what he felt was important for people here. And so I think about especially the voucher issue. And that was where he said, this is not good for West Texas. This is not good for Abilene. It's not good for the surrounding community. So therefore, despite the pressure from on top, the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, I am going to resist it and I'm going to represent the voters. He won re-election, barely, but he won re-election, proving the truth that, at least for him, all politics is local.
Why do you think so many people have announced their candidacy for this? Because you and I, we talked not very long ago about apathy and about how few people were running for office around here. And here this comes open and everybody is announcing.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised at the number of people who've announced, both Republicans and Democrats. It's really intriguing. But at the same time, it's an open seat. So if you have this idea that you've had for 20 years or 30 years or even 2 weeks that I want to get involved in this, you have to do it when it's an open seat. Your best chance of winning is when there's no incumbent there, and this is the time to do it.
In 2024, Liz Case ran against Lambert. She clearly tried to paint Lambert as not conservative enough for West Texas.
Right.
She ran to the far right. Do you see this campaign on the Republican side? Do you think people are going to be running to the far right?
I think that what we have to deal with on the Republican side is that the candidates are already on the far right. And so there is no overwhelming issue like there was on school vouchers last election. So as a consequence, what is the far right? So all of the candidates are going to be talking about the importance of local government, you know, schools and all that stuff. But what is the thing that's really going to be the hook that's going to get into voters? What's the thing that's going to say, hey, this is really important to the most conservative voters? I don't know what that is. So in the absence of an overwhelming issue right now, what I see is that Republicans are all going to say, I'm conservative. I'm conservative, and I'm going to represent conservative values.
This is an interesting election. If you go back all the way to when Stan Lambert announced, nobody's run against him with previous experience, not real previous experience in office. He was, of course, was a AISD school board member. Right now, we've got two people with two of the six on the Republican side have experience. Blaise Reagan, a current city councilman, Jay Hardaway, a former Abilene city councilman. These are some known commodities.
Yeah, and that makes it interesting. What I think people see and why they're entering the race is they see possibilities. They see possibilities for themselves. They see possibilities of getting influence at the state level. And yet, since both Jay and Blaze are young, you see them possibly thinking about where can they go after being state representative. Stan Lambert was farther along in years when he got elected, so there wasn't any sense that he is going to be looking to run for lieutenant governor or anything like that. But I think when you look at some of these candidates, in fact, I think you look at all of them, they might be thinking, okay, maybe in time there might be a statewide office for me.
Well, Paul, you just beat me to my next question, which was, is this going to be a stepping stone? But it does seem like it could be, depending on who wins this thing.
Exactly. There's that potential. There is, I would argue, a generational thing that's going on in the Republican Party where the older establishment kind of Republicans, Stan Lambert is one, are going to be, you know, going off. And so this newer generation, this younger conservative generation is coming in, and what are they going to do and how are they going to go? So on the Democratic side, you know, you have young people, Colin Allred, James Tallarico, talking about running for the U.S. Senate. On the Republican side, I think there's going to be a lot of churning as people think, where can I end up in 20 years?
Paul Fabrizio, thank you for offering us some perspective and clarity today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, George.
Paul Fabrizio is a professor of political science at McMurray University. The District 71 Republican and Democratic primaries are scheduled for March 3rd of 2026, the general election for that seat, November 3rd. If you buy beef, no doubt you've noticed it has gotten more expensive lately. In fact, beef prices in the U.S. are the highest they have ever been, at an average of $9.69 per pound. That's according to the USDA. So when might they come down again? Michael Marks tried to find out.
The Barton Creek Farmers Market pops up on Saturdays in a shopping mall parking lot high on a hill in South Austin. Richardson Farms' booth is tucked into the far back corner.
We raise beef, we raise pork, we do eggs and chicken, we have milk and we have cheese that we make.
That's Jim Richardson, who owns the farm. He and I are talking under a tent while his grandson fetches items out of a fort of coolers. His beef products include stew meat, steak, and ground beef. Lately, they've become pricier.
I went up roughly $1 a pound. My processor went up that much or more, so without kind of keeping up, it erodes your profitability.
Richardson's worked with cattle as a rancher and a veterinarian for more than 50 years, so I asked him about the cost of beef.
Do you have any notion of when prices might come down again?
You know, I don't, and I'd say it's going to be years. It's a real complex issue. And it's not going to remedy quickly.
The big reason why beef prices are so high is that the U.S. cattle herd is really small, the smallest since the 1950s, in fact. Years of drought in cattle country have forced ranchers to sell animals. As the population dwindles, each cow becomes more and more valuable.
So we sell those, and that means then that we don't grow the herd. And that's what the situation we've been in here for a while.
That's Brenda Botel, an agricultural economics professor at the University of Wisconsin River Falls. Despite the costs, she says people are still buying beef.
I'm actually surprised at how resilient beef demand has continued to stay with the very high prices.
At 36 General, a small butcher shop and grocery store in San Marcos, south of Austin, Maddie Bills says that high prices have forced her to pay closer attention than ever before to what ranchers and suppliers charge her.
Checking pricing quarterly because things are fluctuating has been really important for us surviving it all.
Bills buys pork, lamb, and cuts of beef from local ranchers.
We, you know, obviously we get ribeye, tenderloin, strip. Denver is a really popular cut of ours, which is a better value, but it's still really marbled and tender.
The shop is crammed with display cases for cheese and proteins, plus coolers along the walls with veggies, sausage, and chicken feet. In the back, workers marinate ribs, cut sheets of butcher paper, and grind black pepper. Phil said she didn't have a good estimate of when beef prices will drop again, but she has noticed that when buying direct from the source, prices don't tend to jump as dramatically.
Prices have definitely increased across the board. I will say that the more local the product, the more insulated it is from price increases. You know, like the further away you get from the source, the more likely you're going to be playing a game of telephone, and somewhere along the line, someone's going to increase the price and not bring it back down.
So at every step along the beef supply chain, the costs add up. And Battelle, the Wisconsin economist, doesn't expect the high prices to come down anytime soon.
When I'm talking year over year, I don't really see that declining at least through 26.
In fact, she believes prices still have room to go up, at least in the short term.
So I think your August, September, October, we'll still see prices increase.
So those planning a late summer barbecue will need a healthy budget if they plan to serve beef. I'm Michael Marks, Harvest Public Media.
The U.S. House of Representatives approved funds last week to pay for the fuel needed by Abilene Christian University's Next Lab. Congressman Jody Arrington proposed the amendment to an appropriations bill for energy and water development. The Department of Energy has given conditional approval to provide the fuel for research nuclear reactors, and the amendment sets aside $50 million to cover the cost associated with it. KACU's Heather Claiborne spoke with the licensing director for the Next Lab, Lester Towle, and ACU's chief strategy officer, Blair Schrader, to find out what this means for ACU's nuclear project.
So, Blair, I want to start with you. Can you explain how important the funding is for getting this molten salter reactor going?
Yeah, I mean, this project has really been propelled into the national spotlight, and the funding is a big piece of that. So when you look at the legislative process and the process for acquiring the fuel, you've got an allocation process and you've got an appropriation process. What the Department of Energy previously did was they allocated fuel, saying that this fuel, this commodity, if you will, is set aside specifically for this project. It's a fixed fuel amount, and so it's in high demand, but they've basically said this is a significant enough project that we want to make sure that there's enough allocated for the realization of this project. And so that's a huge part of what we're doing.
And is the $50 million just for this project or for reactors at other research projects?
Great question. So the federal government has a program called the University Fuel Services Program, and they have a bucket of money that's specifically tagged, if you will, I don't want to say earmarked, but tagged for university research reactors. And so what this does is historically the Department of Energy has said, hey, that's a limited number of funds that are available for that project. And because of that limited number of funds, they were having a hard time having enough money to cover our new reactor that would be going online. So what happened with Congressman Arrington and other members of getting this amendment across the finish line in the House has basically increased the allotment that goes to this university reactor fund. And the way that it's worded is it will benefit primarily ACU to be able to realize our fuel and salt need. And
will ACU have to, or the Next Lab, have to come up with more funds to help cover these costs, or is this going to do it?
We anticipate that this would be enough. Part of what we've done is we work with the Idaho National Labs and Oak Ridge National Lab to be able to determine what the cost would be. And again, these funds, they really wouldn't even be coming to ACU, but rather they would be going to the National Lab to fabricate the fuel and the salt in the manner and form in which we would need to be able to get that product then to ACU's campus.
And Mr. Towle, are you ready for the fuel? Are you just kind of waiting for that to take the next step in the project?
Loaded question. We're always ready for fuel. Could we put it into the reactor right now? No, because the reactor is not in our trench yet. So, but part of what we're waiting on is that fuel. Until we have the affirmation that we have the fuel and we know what form it's coming in, we can't build the reactor appropriately. And that's part of what makes us different than all the rest of the reactors and all the rest of the research reactors that are in the University Fuel Service Program is that they're all solid fuel, and the Department of Energy knows how to handle solid fuel. We are liquid fuel, and so while the actual fuel itself is uranium, that's the same. The form that we're getting it in is different, and that's new to us. It's also new to them, and so they're having to go through the process of saying, oh, well, this is a different procedure than what we do with the other 25 university research reactors.
So can you simply explain what high-assay, low-enriched uranium is? I mean, we often hear about nuclear programs, maybe in other countries even, that are using highly enriched uranium. And is there an easy way to explain the difference? I know there's a difference between liquid and solid, but between the uranium.
And we call it HALEU because that's a whole lot easier to say than high-assay, low-enriched. But all that means is that you're under 20% enrichment. And the global community has determined that if you're below 20% enrichment, then you can't easily make things blow up. And so if you're below that 20% mark, then that's a safe form of use of the uranium. And so, again, globally, we would like to keep everybody below 20%, and we ourselves are going to stay in that below 20% range. And so that's the high-assay, low-enriched.
Well, I know some community members have expressed their concerns about having a nuclear reactor here on the campus of ACU. Is there anything to be concerned about with this uranium or having a nuclear reactor here in town?
My office is 30 feet away, and so I'm going to have to say no. And again, I would like to alleviate those fears. That takes longer than a very quick conversation. But the easiest thing is to say my office is right there, and if there was a concern, I would not be officing there. But this is magnitudes more safe than the existing reactors, which are already the safest form of energy that we have. And so we are going magnitudes more safe. It's walk-away safe, meaning think of all the bad things that can happen all at once, all the stars align, and there's still no dose to the public.
Dr. Tal did a good job of explaining that. And one of the things I would simply say, too, is I think the Abilene community is uniquely positioned to appreciate what this is and what it's not. And I think part of that is because of Dice Air Force Base. Having weaponry, having explosive things near our community is not something new to us. But what's unique about this effort is truly that it is a low-pressurized system. And so a lot of the general mechanics and design of how nuclear reactors are built, part of what makes this project so unique and has helped generate so much support for it is because it's not like what we've ever seen before. So hopefully I think most people in the community will recognize that really this is everything they knew about nuclear reactors is really kind of gone by the wayside in light of this new type of technology.
Blair, the state of Texas also approved major funding this year for the project in collaboration with Texas Tech. Are there other approvals ACU is watching or waiting for with this reactor?
Sure. You know, we've really had a very productive 2025 as it relates to this project. And you identified the $120 million allocation that the state of Texas awarded this project as a result of the partnership with Texas Tech and the Texas Produced Water Consortium. Our partners at Natura were the recipients of really some direct action by the Trump administration with some of his executive orders that happened over the summer, where they've challenged the United States to lean into new nuclear fuel forms headed into 2026. So they were the beneficiaries of an executive order that came out of that pilot project. So we're always paying attention. The good news is that as these things come to light, it really has been the result of many years of work. I've been at ACU on this project for about 4 years, but it started long before that. And so really what you're seeing is the awareness and the momentum is growing. And I also think it's important to note that this administration has made this a priority. And so as a result of that, we're at the right place at the right time. But then also when you look in the more global scale, as you look at AI data centers, as you look at projects like Stargate, there is a significant global need for energy and resources. And our project is uniquely positioned to be able to deliver on that. And we're building off of that momentum.
Can you explain, Mr. Towell, how that's going to work, that the project here at ACU's campus has the potential to kind of support some of the things that they need at the Stargate project?
Absolutely. We have three pillars that we kind of lean into when we're talking about our reactor, that medical isotopes and clean drinking water. But the third one is energy. And energy is easy because any data center, any AI center, they just eat energy, and you can't have enough. It's kind of like cash in your wallet. You can never have enough. Data centers will never have enough energy. And so the faster that we can get clean, affordable energy to them, the better they're going to do.
And before we go, tell us where the project stands. What's left to be done before you're online?
So we physically have to put the parts in the trench. And so the reactor has to be put down in the trench. We have to test it. Then we have to put fuel in it. Then we can turn it on. And that's an oversimplification. But according to our timeline, that could be as early as next year. Again, the largest tentpole in this is the fuel and the salt.
Well, we look forward to continuing to hear about this project. We'll have you back sometime. Thank you both for your time.
Great. Thank you.
That was KACU's Heather Claiborne speaking with Lester Tao, Licensing Director of the NextLab, and Blair Schrader, Chief Strategy Officer for Abilene Christian University. Texas Tech University's Goin' Band from Raiderland kicked off the football season this year with a centennial celebration for the band. But plans for a grand halftime performance featuring both the current Goin' Band and over 1,000 alumni musicians were washed out by the rain. KTTZ's Bishop Van Buren has the story.
This year will be the Goin' Band from Raiderland's 100th anniversary, and to celebrate, over 1,000 alumni returned to Lubbock for a packed slate of events, including a halftime show that never happened. The band held a fan performance on the grassy knoll outside of Tech School of Music a few hours before kickoff for the Red Raider season opener. I stood among the audience, watching alumni and current members joyfully play together, ignoring the sprinkling drops of rain. Then the sky cleared up for a bit, and it seemed for a moment there wouldn't be any interruption. But by halftime, more storm clouds and rain had rolled in, and field conditions forced organizers to cancel the halftime performance.
Once we knew that things were looking just a little, you know, a little too scary to go out there, we ultimately decided the only option was to do something post-game. Unfortunately, by that point, the weather delay had become pretty long to the point where some of the alumni, they just couldn't hang around much longer.
That's Texas Tech's Director of Athletic Bands, Dr. Joel Pagan. He said weather concerns had been on the radar for days, and that he was part of multiple consultations with football operations and the National Weather Service. But still, despite the rain, he says he took a lot of pride in watching alumni interact and rehearse with current members, knowing the hurdles some alumni overcame to relive their favorite traditions.
We had people traveling all the way from New Jersey by car to be here for this weekend. It's just really cool to see them come back, and it's like they never left.
Returning alumni still enjoyed a weekend of events that included a silent auction, multiple social gatherings, and a banquet on Sunday. The responsibility of planning those events fell on the shoulders of the Goin' Band Alumni Association's Centennial Coordinator, Kelly Gordon. I spoke with Gordon last week, before alumni weekend. She told me she was given her position in early 2023 and has since then been organizing celebrations of the band's 100th year. Gordon said one of the most rewarding parts of the job has been seeing how the band's traditions create connections across generations.
I think that's something that makes this particular group the largest and the oldest spirit organization on campus, something that's really special.
I spoke with her again on Monday, this time to recap the weekend.
We have received feedback from really, and I'm going to say 99% of our alums said, who cares about halftime? The best part of this was getting to see and be with one another, to be with people we haven't seen in so long. And, that was our ultimate goal.
She told me she was running on around 12 hours of sleep since Friday, when most of the alumni arrived in town. Even with the change of plans and the stress of the weekend, she said everything aside from the halftime show couldn't have gone better.
Seeing happy faces, hearing people scream when they figured out that somebody, they didn't know exactly who was going to be there. And so then they see them and they just the excitement, the sheer joy on people's faces and in their voices had me nearly in tears. I was just thrilled to see so many happy reunions.
Gordon met her husband during their time together in the Goin' Band, and their daughter eventually joined as well. Saturday's rehearsal was the first time they got to be on a field together. Gordon was positioned on the tower, tasked with making sure things looked like they should.
Dr. Pagan and his crew were worried about what does it sound like, and do we have people in the right spot? Mine was, you know, does it look like it spells out 100, and do we have everybody where they need to be?
From her view, she could see her husband, a former drum major, directing the side of the band that included their daughter just a few yards away.
To look at him and get to look at her and to see the whole group and how it came together was just overwhelming.
Gordon said the Alumni Association is still working to confirm other celebrations moving forward this year, with hopes of doing a social event during the basketball season. The next board meeting is in October, and she expects an announcement shortly thereafter. She also added that because the rain stopped this year's halftime show, there might be another attempt in the works.
We've already kind of received some tentative approval that next year, in 2026, we may be spelling out 101 since we didn't get to have our 100 this year. Honestly, even though I'm so tired and I have absolutely no voice, I mean, my voice is just dead. I'm ready to do it all again. It was that much fun.
For KTTZ, I'm Bishop Van Buren.
Hunting season is in full swing across Texas, and with dove season underway, hospitals are reminding hunters to keep safety top of mind. Joining us today is Dr. John Russell. He is an emergency physician at Hendrick Health, and he's here to talk about common injuries, how to prevent them, and how to be safe out there. Dr. Russell, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, yeah, happy to be here.
Okay, so let's talk about hunting season. It's dove hunting season, obviously. What kind of injuries do you see?
Mainly it's people getting peppered with birdshot. Shotguns shoot the small pellets that we call birdshot, and it's comparable to a rifle. It's low velocity, so unless you're really close, these are usually minor injuries. Sometimes, though, people do get hit in sensitive areas like their eyes, and so we always want people to be wearing eye protection, even if it's just some sunglasses. Of course, be aware of where their muzzle is pointed at all times. Be aware of what's beyond your target. Don't shoot at something unless you know what's behind it. And know who's with you and where they are in the field. You know, people like to get a lot of people in these dove fields to keep the dove moving, but sometimes that makes for accidents, too.
Dr. Russell, this is West Texas, and it may be September, but we can definitely have some hot days. I have to think that heat is part of what you guys see in the ER.
Yeah, 100%. And it feels like it stays hot, you know, until Thanksgiving almost nowadays. So certainly people, you know, they're out in the woods and they're having a good time, and they get behind on drinking fluids. They get overheated. Sometimes you can get stupid when you're dehydrated. So besides just the heat injuries, you think you're best when you're well hydrated. And so I recommend people find a shady spot when they're out, make sure they've got plenty of water, and if they're drinking any adult beverages, that they're not drinking too many, and that they've got plenty of water to go with it.
What are the most preventable accidents you see out there in the field? In other words, you know exactly what I just said. What's the most preventable?
I kind of mentioned things that come from poor muzzle discipline and just poor safety practices. But sometimes, you know, people are out there and they're doing everything right, and they may be something as simple as, you know, cutting yourself with a knife or whatever when you're field dressing your game. I recommend people get some Kevlar gloves to prevent those hand injuries.
All right. Dr. Russell, thank you so much for joining us. And that's some fabulous advice before people hit the fields.
Yeah, anytime. Enjoyed doing it.
Dr. Russell, emergency physician with Hendrick Health, sharing important reminders on dove season. Stay safe and enjoy it out there. It's time for West Texas Roots. As summer winds down, so does a small town tradition in Albany. The Fandangle is more than a musical spectacular about Albany and Shackelford County. It is a celebration of heritage and community pride. Riley Scott shares her story of how the Fandangle connects neighbors through history and storytelling.
Fandangle is the oldest outdoor musical in Texas. The entire Albany community and even some Moran community members put on this musical every June for the last two weekends in June, like voluntarily. So no one really gets paid for it besides like your Fandangle staff. we basically tell the story of how Albany came to be. So think back like cowboys, Indians, the story of Fort Griffin, and then the story of Albany. So it ends, and you've got like musical numbers, dancing. We have like can-can dances and the Beehive. Okay, so the first Beehive saloon was in Albany, and then now we have one in Abilene, and because of Ali and his brother, but it tells the whole story of that. Fort Griffin General Merchandise was the old Beehive in Albany. But that one was first, Abilene was second, and now Abilene's the only one remaining. So think about it, if you're traveling for the Fandangle and then you see the Beehive Saloon, you can go get a drink at the Beehive, and it's a musical number and a song in the Fandangle. I mean, that's just not there anymore, which is kind of sad. But, you know. And then a different steakhouse opened up there called Good Nights, which is good. It's just not the Beehive.
I was a freshman in high school, so I was 14. That's just because I moved to Albany when I was a freshman. And so, like high school ages, we did partner dances. But there's like little babies. So you have the tiniest kids that run around dressed like Indians or holding plants and like swaying in the wind, all the way up to your old timers, like old folks. So there's a whole wide range of ages. We present it in an outdoor prairie theater. So it's outdoors. It's got a little like theater seating, and then you have a grassy lawn area. But yeah, everyone of all ages does it. But when I moved there, my mom is actually from Albany. So, and she did it as a kid. So of course we did it as kids, me and my sister. Mm-hmm. And my mom and dad did it as well. But yeah. Oh, Huppy High, that's the dance. Okay, there's this dance that your high school kids did called Huppy High. And so you had a partner, and it was a whole partner dance, and everyone was clapping around, and that was part of it. But I was 14 when I started, and then did it for 4 years till I graduated. And so when I got older, I got to be a saloon girl, which is super fun, learning the can-can. So they had a scene representing the old Beehive, like in the Fort Griffin days. And so you had the can-can music playing, and then you were dressed with a saloon girl, feather in your hair, like stockings on, garter. And that was super fun. But it truly is just a volunteer effort. My great-grandpa was part of the very, very first Fandangle. So Robert Nail wrote the Fandangle, and so my great-grandpa was kind of in his class at Albany, and they first did it on the football field in Albany, and then kind of graduated to the Prairie Theater once it was built. There's a whole collection of old either skits or songs that Robert Nail had made, and even some other people had written to perform at the Fandangle for over years. So her job as a director, she typically plans how the entire play is going to go, the musical goes, and then she just kind of see who shows up to volunteer to put on the show for the year, and then directs certain skits and songs. There's a snake skit that typically always makes it, or Puppy High, but if there's not enough high schoolers, then that's cut out. So she changes up the skits every year. So it's not the same show or the same musical each year, which is kind of unique.
But yeah, that's cool.
Just depends on what local talent she has. Yeah. Last 2 weekends in gym. Gotcha. So they do something called a Fandangle sampler. I think they still do it. They go out to LBJ and perform a little sampler, and then the true show is June.
We recorded Riley's story in Abilene. Maybe you saw them when they went through Abilene last week. The multi-generational Western swing band Asleep at the Wheel turned 55 this year. The milestone was marked with the release of their new album, Riding High in Texas. The band was also inducted into the Texas Country Music Hall of Fame just this month. KACU's Alexis Jones spoke with longtime band leader Ray Benson about the new album, the ongoing tour, and what it means to carry the band's legacy into the next 50 years.
If you just want to start by giving me a little bit of the history of the band.
Oh, my. All 55 years?
Well, I mean, if you want to kind of give me, I know it's a really long history because, like, everybody that I know has kind of grown up listening to some iteration of it.
Well, me and a couple of guys started the band in 1970 in West Virginia and moved to California. Got a record deal in 1972 and put out a record and moved to Texas at the end of 1973. So that was the beginning. And it was to form a band that played roots American music. And that was our basic idea, and put that in and be a country western band. So that was the impetus, and that's how it all started. We wound up in Texas. I met Willie Nelson and Doug Sim back in '70s, and they all said, "You sound like you're from Texas. Why aren't you down in Austin?" Came down and played here in the '72, and it made our way here and wound up working with Willie for many years. You know, they became known as a band that we did three Bob Wills tribute albums over the years, and cemented ourselves as a western swing band. But we also do, obviously, we did country music, boogie woogie swing, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that's basically how it all went down.
Yeah. So the band has changed a lot of faces over the years. How does that work? Like, how do you keep it going?
Yeah, we've had over 100 people in the band. Essentially, when somebody new joins the band, I tell them, okay, here's what went before you. Learn all that on your instrument or your vocal and add something to it. And bring whatever it is that you bring to the table, bring that to the band, and that changes how we do things. So that's basically how that happens. Over the years, you know, when I started the band, I'm of the baby boom generation. There were very few people of my age that could play this kind of music. And so over the years, it's been a real education. And nowadays, the current band is people in their 30s and 20s and 40s who have learned this music over the years. And so it's become a lot easier to find people who know how to play it.
So whenever somebody comes to you and says that they're ready to retire from the band, how do you start the search for the next person?
Well, there's a grapevine out there, you know. And right now, it's a lot of phone calls. For instance, we have the drummer, and he can play most of the gigs, but he also works with Culture Wall, who works, he only doesn't do a lot, you know, but he works 30 or 40 shows a year. So I said, fine, you go ahead and then we'll find somebody else. So then we'll call around. And it's really just a question of talking to all the other people, saying, hey, this gig is open. We need somebody with these qualifications. And then it's just a process of finding them and then vetting whether they're capable and willing to do it.
Yeah. Is the band always touring, or do y'all take a little bit of time off?
A couple of weeks off is really the amount, you know. So, yes, we're pretty much every month we're playing somewhere.
Yeah. So what's it like for you, like having done this for so long, like always being on the road? Do you enjoy that?
I love it, man. You know, I get in that bus, and we played with Lyle Lovett the other day, and I said, you know, Lyle, even after 55 years, it's still a lunch for me that I'm able to stare out the window and look at this incredible country, because it really is amazing. You know, from the other day, we're in West Virginia, and the hills of West Virginia are just so gorgeous, and you forget. Then we were up in the Panhandle the other day at Dumas, Texas, to see a high desert, how different that is. So, yeah, I'm just a tourist, I guess.
Yeah, so y'all go everywhere on a bus.
Yeah, for instance, we were just finished an East Coast tour. And so we finished up in Cape Cod and then we got on a plane and flew home. But yeah, other than the beginning of the tour and end of the tour, we might go. But yeah, we get on that old bus and go.
That's crazy. Do you have like a favorite memory or one that stands out to you over the past few decades of touring?
I got 1,000. You know, I the highlights, yeah, sure. Willie Nelson, we've worked hundreds of shows with Willie, dozens of records, TV shows, etc. It's always a pleasure. You know, it's always an incredible to me. I've just been a big Willie Nelson fan, even though he's a friend of mine. You know, I started out as a fan when I met him in 1971. You know? So Willie shows are always just to me amazing. But of course, yeah, we've toured with Bob Dylan. God, you know, we did done shows with everybody, and just sharing the stage with these legendary people to me has been a reward enough.
What do you see as the legacy for the band? Like, you've kind of seen it, like you were saying, grow in the amount of people that can fit into this type of band. So what do you see as the future for it?
Well, it's been said of us that we helped with other people, not just being a Steve Wheel, but help bring Western swing music back into the mainstream. You know, we started doing Western swing music in 1972, and then George Strait came along and heard our records, and he started doing them. And so I think that's a legacy that is hard to deny, you know. Just that alone. And then, of course, the legacy of being a touring band that plays improvisational music.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks for talking to me today.
You bet. Thanks, and we'll hope to see you in Abilene.
Yes, sir. Have a good day.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. Plan to join us and tell a friend. And if your friend isn't able to tune in Wednesdays at noon, that's okay. We can be available wherever you are. The West Texas Dispatch is on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can find it on the KACU mobile app or online anytime. We had help this week from our team of producers, Heather Claiborne and Alexis Jones, and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. Special thanks to J.C. Gamble, who wrote our theme. I'm George Levesque.